Good evening. If you'll turn over to the book of Hebrews, where we were this morning, we're going to look at many of the same passages we looked at this morning, but with a different spin. This morning we were talking about how Jesus is the most perfect example of Hebrews 11 and what we saw with those who were of faith. And so we are focusing on verse 2 of chapter 12, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Tonight we're going to focus on verse 1. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. Sadly, ladies and gentlemen, I have to say I did not come up with this sermon on my own. There is a gentleman by the name of Patrick Coffin who preaches in Nashville, and he was doing... We're going to be looking at some different points, but this was the general idea. I'm sure Phil can tell you, preachers have to get ideas wherever they can. But I thought that he did a good job, and I thought the message was one that needed to be shared with you all this evening. Also, with this being Jill's and my final service with you as far as 2017 goes, I figured we sort of have an end of the year lesson as well. I want us to focus on two major points here in verse 1. Notice that the Hebrew writer says, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Notice these two here together. Encumbrance, a weight, something that holds us back, holds us down. And notice that that doesn't necessarily mean a sin. There might be other things that are holding us back. It may not just be sins. And notice this whole idea of enduring, first of all, is the entire point of the book of Hebrews, but especially here in 10 through 12. He's focusing on faith and having a faith that endures. Notice going back to chapter 10. Going back to chapter 10, verses 35 and 36, where Tim read for us this evening. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. Notice here the contrast. In verse 36, you have need of endurance so that when you've done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. But in 12, verse 1, if we are not laying aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and we are not running with endurance the race that is set before us, then this is all in vain. We will not receive what we have promised. What we have been promised is if we are fulfilling the word of God, that we have been baptized, that we are following our lives in accordance with His will, then we will receive eternal life. But that's not what will happen if we are not laying aside any of the weights that hold us back. If you ever... watch, right now we have the Winter Olympics coming, but going back to the Summer Olympics, if you watch any of the track events, all the runners, they are trying to reduce as much drag as possible. They're wearing very light materialed clothing. Their shoes weigh no more than a feather. They're trying to reduce all of the weights that can hold them back. Something that can help them go even further. And you get some of that with the cross-country skiing that we're going to see in the Winter Olympics here. But this idea of laying aside every encumbrance means we can run as quickly as possible. And when we think about this from the standpoint of a spiritual nature, a spiritual race that we're trying to run, This is more about, can we last? Not necessarily speed, but can we last? Hence, let us run with endurance. This is a cross-country race. This is one that is miles and miles long. This is more of a marathon than anything. And the older we get, doesn't it feel more like a marathon? Life just feels like it takes longer and longer the more you go. So I want us to go back into Hebrews 11. And I want us to look. I don't want us to spend too much time on each point, but I want us to go back through and look at some of the people mentioned here and think about some of the weights that could have held them back. First, I actually want to start. We're going to skip the first couple of people. We're going to start in verse 7. We're going to start with Noah. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, in reverence prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. First of all, some of the weights that Noah could have had, people aren't listening to him. He wants more time to reach people. Is that a bad thing? Absolutely not. He's wanting to spend as much time as he can, not just preparing an ark, but making sure that people are going to be able to come and partake of this salvation from the flood that is going to come. But he has a very strict schedule. God tells him, you have this many years to build this ark, and then the flood will come, with or without you being prepared. You see, Noah, he was warned ahead of time. Being warned by God about things not yet seen. Hence why this had to be taken on faith. Also, if the scriptures are to be believed at their very word, it seems that rain was not a part of the world cycle at that point. It says that water came up from the ground in order to water plants. There was no rainfall. So that the idea that there's something that the world could actually do that had never been done before is already somewhat of a crazy notion for the people at this time. They had never seen rain. So how could there be enough rain, enough water falling from the sky to flood the entire world? You see, there are all these things that could have held him back. They're not necessarily sins, but they could have held him back. And notice, prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness, which is according to faith. You see, he built this ark and no one wanted to get on it. It's not Noah's fault. But if Noah had felt like that, then we could have had an encumbrance here. Abraham, we could have a lot to talk about. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. I don't know the way. I don't know how much I need to prepare for this journey. I don't know what I'm going to find when I get there. Is it going to be a barren wasteland? Having those questions, there's nothing really wrong with having those questions. But they certainly could have held Abraham back. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. He could have had many things holding him back and holding him down. I'm tired of wandering. But that's not what Abraham is thinking, because verse 10 tells us what he's thinking. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder. Notice I've always read that sentence as the city which has foundations. Well, that's kind of every city. But I think what it's really saying is it has foundations, an architect, and a builder. All three of those are God. The foundations are God, the architect is God, and the builder is God. He's looking for something far beyond. He's looking for that living with God forever. And so having these weights to hold him down and to pull him back, that's not even in Abraham's mind. If you go over to 17, verse 17, continuing with Abraham. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, "In Isaac your descendants shall be called." He considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. So here, Abraham could have asked, "God, isn't there some other thing I could sacrifice? Couldn't I sacrifice bulls? Couldn't I sacrifice a pure lamb? Why do I have to sacrifice the one son that I've been waiting for?" If you recall, Abraham even took it into his own hands to try to have a son. And they had Ishmael, and God says, no, you're going about it the wrong way. And so then he had to wait even longer. This son whom he was waiting for, God says, you need to offer him as a sacrifice. And Abraham says, God knows what he's doing. He's not wondering why. That's not necessarily wrong, is it, to simply wonder why? He doesn't ask God if there's some other way he could go about it. What it says is he gets up in the morning and takes his son and his servants and they go. Because he considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead. Which, by the way, is something that, from what the Bible has told us, has never happened before. He has no precedent for that. And in fact, especially at this time, if you look back at extra-biblical accounts of other cultures at this time, the resurrection of the dead is a silly notion. Even getting into when the prophets like Isaiah are talking about the resurrection, people were looking at that from other cultures and saying, how dumb is that, raising people from the dead? Once you're dead, that's it. That's not a very typical notion, but Abraham is so confident in God. So what happens? He goes to sacrifice and God ends up stopping him and giving him a ram instead. But he said, because you sacrificed your son. Did he? Well, no. But he had already determined there was nothing holding him back. Go back to verse 11. By faith, even Sarah herself received ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, there was born even of one man, and him as good as dead at that, as many descendants as the stars of heaven in number, and innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. And Sarah's story is somewhat interesting when you go back and read it in Genesis, because I think we see some of this. We see some of the encumbrances, both she and Abraham. Oh, surely God's not going to use my 90-year-old body to give birth to a son. Surely not. And she ends up at one point sort of mocking at God, to which she is severely chastised for. And Abraham and Sarah both have their own weights about it, to the point where he tries to have a child with her maidservant, Hagar. And then we saw what happened. When the weights that take us down get a hold of us, we end up going against the Word of God. And then we have a child, Ishmael, who is not supposed to receive the blessings that God had been promised. And he and Hagar's life was somewhat difficult. God did what he did to help them. But I think Abraham and Sarah are a perfect example that when you have these weights in the back of your mind, It never helps. It never lets you run to your fullest extent. Isaac and Jacob were able to bless their children. It could be easy, especially looking at Jacob and Esau. Goodness, what went on between those two brothers? It would be easy for Isaac to change his mind, to go against what he had promised. Those would have been easy for him. Jacob was deceiving him, so he's going to go ahead and bless Esau anyway. But that's not what Isaac does. Isaac follows through on his promises. And Jacob could have thought, there's no way my children are going to leave Egypt. We're all moving down here to be with Joseph because there's a famine in the land. They're not going back. They're going to be settled here, and they're going to love it here, and they're never going to want to leave. So why give them the blessings of going back home? There's not really much of a point. That's not what Jacob does. And Joseph, I think it's interesting, we don't really think about this until we read it here in Hebrews 11. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. How long after Joseph died does it take the people to leave? 450 years. To leave. But Joseph's not thinking that. He knows that they're going to leave. He knows that God is going to grant the promises that he will. So even if the people have to wait 450 years, Joseph is confident that God will fulfill his promises. Moses, poor Moses, had to deal with so much. Remember when God threatened in Moses' presence, how about I just wipe out all of Israel and take these stones and start over? Make these stones into my children. Moses had so much. At the start of his life, he had so much going for him. Despite Pharaoh trying to kill him and all that, of course. But he finds Pharaoh's daughter. And you know what? That could have been really easy. How about I help my people by being the son of Pharaoh's daughter? How about that? I bet I could do a lot of good, maybe Moses would have thought. I could convince Pharaoh to have certain edicts to help the people out of their slavery. I could take my riches and give them to the people so they would have money to do business. None of those would be wrong, would they? But they would have been weights for Moses. Because we see that when he, as verse 24 says, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. Notice when he unshackled himself, what was he able to do? Lead the people out of the land of Egypt. Defeat the Egyptian army. Of course, all with the help of God. And giving them the law that would be with them for over 1,000 years. Because he had gotten rid of the weights that so easily ensnared him, could have ensnared him. It says, by faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. He had faith that God existed and that he is a reward, that he rewards those who seek him. By the way, that's verse 6 of the same chapter, isn't it? Having faith that he is. You see, not being able to see God at times was not a hindrance for Moses. It can be for us. And it is for so many people. Well, God isn't something I can physically touch or see, so how can I think He exists? That's a weight that so easily ensnares so many people. By faith, He kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them. Do I have to kill a lamb to put blood on the door to keep the destroyer out? Oh, yes. And he did, and he saved so many people. Passed through the Red Sea, as we've already said. Of course, we just spoke about Jericho, didn't we? That was last week. We were talking about the walls of Jericho. And what was it they had to fight Jericho with? They had their feet, they had their trumpets, and they had their mouths. Not exactly something to take down walls that were thick enough to have chariot races on. Marching doesn't exactly help that. Maybe some battering rams and some siege engines would help. How about we build those? We'll help God along. Certainly we'll need them for war, right? Those are things that everybody uses for war. So shouldn't we make some for ourselves? That would have been a hindrance for them. They would have relied on those things instead of relying on God. And all they did was walk around a city and then blow some trumpets and shout. I have to say, that probably would have been a hindrance for me. That would have been tough for me to take at face value. Walk around the city a few times, shout, maybe a little do-do-do, and the walls will come tumbling down. Uh-huh. But that's exactly what happened. And then in verse 32, the Hebrew writer mentions all of these other names that he would love to talk about but doesn't have the time for. And he goes into these, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions. You want to go to Daniel for some not being hindered help? It was illegal to even pray to God, but that didn't hold him back. Quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. That doesn't sound like people who have little voices in the back of their mind stopping them, holding them back. Women received back their dead by resurrection, others tortured, not accepting their release so that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. Verse 37 always gets me every time. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted. They were put to death with a sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. Doesn't exactly sound like people who are shackled by problems of this world. The one that always gets me is the sawn in two. Doesn't sound like they're being held back by anything. And having something that holds you back, what's in that parenthesis in 38? Men of whom the world was not worthy. Those aren't people being held back by anything. Because when we're worthy of the world, that's a bad thing. That's a bad worthiness. I don't want to be worthy of the world because that means I have something holding me back. All these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised. Then what was the point? They didn't receive what was promised. Why even do it? First of all, verse 40, because God had provided something better for us. But chapter 12, verse 2, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. And of course, as always, my wife, I hadn't been preaching here but for a few months. And to be honest, I don't even remember what I was preaching on. But I said, you know, that sounds like Jesus. And I started going off into a point by that. And we were driving home. And she said, honey, every point that you ever make, you always seem to bring it back to Jesus. And that wasn't her getting on to me. She was just saying, yeah, I noticed that you do that. But isn't that ultimately the case? Everything always comes back to Jesus. And so you want someone who wasn't held back? Jesus knew what was coming. He knew what was coming for years. At the age of 12, he tells his parents, I have to be about my father's business. It really makes me wonder how much he knew at that point. But even when he started his ministry, that's 3 years of waiting for the end to come and knowing that you're going to suffer the most horrible death for a whole bunch of people who hated you. Spit on you while you were hanging there in pain and anguish. It says that Jesus even asked God, just don't make me go through this. He was sweating blood. You think he might have had some weights that might have held him back? I don't need to do this. All of you hate me anyway. Why do I have to die one of the most horrific deaths possible? Let me just go be with my father and leave you to yourselves. Did he have a right to do that? Yes. He absolutely had a right to do that. But that's not where Jesus' mind was. As we said when we were talking about Job this morning in Bible class, God is so many steps ahead of us. And that was where Jesus was too. That's where all these people were. Because verse 40 of chapter 11, because God had provided something better for us. All these people of faith are so many steps ahead. There can't be anything that holds them back. There's nothing left to hold them back. Because they are fixing their eyes on Jesus. And notice what it said about Moses back in chapter 11. He considered the reproach of Christ greater riches. Whether they knew it or not, they were all setting their eyes on Jesus. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us. What are witnesses most often used for? Court cases. You see, everybody in chapter 11 judges us. That's really what they're witnessing. They're surrounding us and saying, are you going to follow in our path? Since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith. Lay aside every encumbrance. We have a new year coming. It's right around the corner. It never feels like that until it gets here. It's right around the corner. And if you have something holding you back, you're not going to be counted with the rest of Hebrews 11. I can tell you that right now. You remember the whole quenched the power of fire that we talked about this morning? How Jesus quenched the power of fire. He got us rid of the fear of hell. That does not apply to you if you have something holding you back. Holding you back means you are not running to your fullest extent. And if you're not running to your fullest extent, I think that means you're not fixated on Jesus. You're not fixated on the promises of God. You're not fixated on doing what you need to do to survive this life. So tonight, you have an opportunity to rid yourself of the weight of any encumbrance and any sin that so easily entangles us. You have that chance. If you haven't been baptized, if you haven't become a child of God, taken those first steps of the process, that's where you need to be. That's where you need to come up and do that tonight. Because you're not going to have tomorrow. You never have tomorrow. And so, first of all, that's ridding yourself of the old man. That's the biggest weight. That's the biggest encumbrance that holds us back is the old man. And you're baptized and you get rid of that weight. Now, if you have, there are some weights for you if you have been baptized. There are things holding you back. Come up here and get rid of them. They're holding you back from the Lord. Whichever opportunity applies to you, we're going to be singing a song. So all things are ready. Hear the invitation, come whosoever will. This is an invitation that always extends to everyone in the audience. We always like to think, oh yeah, that the invitation is for people who have never been baptized. No. It's for you too. It's for you too. Whichever opportunity applies most to you, take advantage of it right now as we stand and sing, all things are ready.